Bonfield Lure, and the date is May 28th, 2000, and I'm at 107 Caldwell Street interviewing my friend Edwin Caldwell. Ed, can you tell me about growing up in Chapelville?
Specifically, what do you want to know? You want to know about family? You just want me to sort of just talk?
That would be great.
Okay.
Anything that comes to mind.
Well, growing up in Chapel Hill was really unique. Being here with the university and having everything at the university at our disposal, you know, made us different. And you can look at the number of my friends that grew up here. They just had a different perspective than a lot of other black youth from all over North Carolina. My earliest recollections was that I lived with my grandmother, and her name was Alice Neal, at 407 West Franklin Street. Where that is now is the McDonald's on Franklin Street, is the site of her home place. Those were very happy times because I was there with two cousins, and later a third cousin whose parents died moved in, and my grandmother sort of adopted her. We were all raised like family. Let me back up and say that in the back was my grandmother's best friend, Miss Ifitella, and we were all related. All her grandchildren also lived there, and we were in and out of each other's house. We were all raised like brothers and sisters. The only thing is we just lived in different houses. Those were very happy times. And I don't know what to say. It's just that it was just marvelous. Go ahead.
How is it you grew up? Were your parents there with you, your grandmother? Or?
Yes. When my mother and father got married, they lived with my grandmother. My aunt and her husband, Aunt Frances Hargraves, also lived there. It was a big house with many rooms. My grandmother also took in boarders. So anybody that was in that house was almost like family. Miss Effitella, that lived in the back, they sit on my grandmother's porch, you know, and they just conversed, and they were just the best of friends. Other neighbor also came, and the porch was a social place that they talked and whatever. In the wintertime, the kitchen was the place that they got together, and was always food. You know, my grandmother fed just about everybody in the neighborhood. So it was really just a great place to grow up. On Sundays and holidays, those were special times because my grandmother had a sister that lived in Durham. They came to Chapel Hill every Sunday, and they sit on the front porch and they talk. My grandmother's sister, her name was Hessie Mitchell. They raised my mother. So Aunt Hessie and her husband, Willis, were just like my grandparents, too. And, you know, you could feel the love, you know, just radiating. And for a long time, I didn't understand why he loved me so. You know? And it was because my aunt raised my mother. So those were very special times living up on Franklin Street. I also had a grandmother that lived over on Church Street. Her name was Minnie Caldwell. And just the legacy of the Caldwell family was sort of outstanding. I didn't really understand why, when people found out that I was a Caldwell, they always sort of treated me special. You know, they always said you come from a very special family. So they were long time, five generations on both sides. I'm told, and I remember reading somewhere, that my father married my mother because my father had an uncle that gave him land where we're sitting now if he would marry my mother. just the, you know, the strength of the two families. And my uncle knew that my father couldn't do any better marrying Alice Neal's daughter. So I come from a very strong background, strong parentage. I grew up, my father worked at the Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity house, and I grew up in that fraternity house. He started taking me up there when I was a baby. My earliest recollection of being there was that I was 4 years old, and he had me working at the fraternity at four. It was unbelievable because I was little Eddie. You have to understand the special relationship that my father had with the Deeps. He was a mentor. And it was sort of confusing because I grew up under segregation, and I guess when I was in the fraternity house, I was little Eddie, and I was treated sort of special. Now let me back up and say everybody in the fraternity didn't treat me that way. You could always tell who were the good people from who were not so good. In segregation, when I say good, in the house they always treated me as little Eddie and I'm special. But when you go downtown and you meet a Deep, he would pass you. If he passed you and wouldn't speak to you, you know that he wasn't so good. He was probably adhering to the mores and so forth of the times. There were others that really didn't care. And I was little Eddie wherever they saw me. Okay, and that's how I identified the good from the bad, if you want to call them bad. Those Deeks took a special interest in me. There were people that, like Dr. Sid Alexander, he later went on to get his medical degree. Every time that I went to clean up his room, he always sit me down and he had pep talks. You know, he always told me, I want you to be somebody. And he helped me with homework, and he just talked to me about things that he thought I should know. And he just comes to mind. There were others like Roy Holston that was with the business school. Roy always had a special interest in me. You know? Even as I grew up, and when I went off to college, you know, he always say, you know, how you doing in school and that sort of thing. So I grew up with a lot of support. Now on my mother's side, my grandmother, Alice Neal, worked for Dr. Frank Graham. Okay, he was president of the university. Dr. Frank, we were family. And there were many times that my grandmother took us to, we'd just say, the president's house. And we played in the yard or whatever. We didn't do that often, but Dr. Frank wanted us to come to the president's house, and he also talked to us about the value of education and whatever. I remember going there just about every year. You know, we'd dress up and we'd go through and he'd ask us, you know, how we're doing in school and that sort of thing. You could feel that Dr. Frank was very, very special. And my grandmother, Mr. Hubert Robinson, who was his chauffeur, had a very special relationship. Now, for many years, Dr. Frank was a single man, and he later married. We call him Miss Marion. I guess there was a little friction as to Miss Marion telling my grandmother what she ought to cook for Dr. Frank, you know, and my grandmother says, well, I've been cooking, you know, all along, and I know what Dr. Frank likes to eat, you know. And so she continued to cook the way she wanted to. You got to understand, Alice Neal, man, very strong woman, wasn't going to let anybody tell her pretty much what to do. So those are some early recollections of what it was like. I moved about in Chapel Hill and on the university campus pretty freely. In fact, all blacks moved about pretty freely, you know, on the campus.
Campus was all white then?
All white. One of the things in growing up in Chapel Hill, we developed some very special relationships with some of the white kids that went to Chapel Hill High. We had some very good, I mean, we're just good friends, you know. Every year, we used to go to Keenan Stadium and we'd play a football game to see who had the best football team in town. You know, the parents didn't allow us to play together, but we pretty much decided what we were going to do anyway. We were friends and we played this rivalry game to see who had, you know, Chapel Hill versus Lincoln, you know. And a lot of competition. We played basketball to see who would have the best basketball teams. And we really, you know, I guess some of my best friends were, just happened to be white. You know, we had great relationships as children. My grandmother's yard backed up to white parents and so forth, and so we played football together. They had kids and whatever, and they come out in the field and we played. You know, so I really didn't feel like that. I mean, you know, we see these friends downtown and we were friends. One of my best friends was a fellow by the name of Rennie Randolph. Just sort of a super guy. He's a little bit older than I was and just, I don't know, just sort of thought the world of me, you know. He has since moved from Chapel Hill, but we kept a good friendship, you know, even long after we were married and that sort of thing. And others kept good friendships and so forth. So that was pretty much some of the early recollections of what it was like. I know you want to ask me some questions.
I love just hearing you talk. Yeah. That's really what I want you to do, exactly.
Yeah. We understood when you leave Chapel Hill that, you know, your parents taught you what you need to understand to survive. Okay. I mean, as a black male, they taught you the do's and don'ts and whatever. We grew up pretty astute of being able to read, let's just say, the other culture. Okay. And even today, I'm very perceptive, you know, from just reading body languages and eyes and other physiological changes. So when a person talks to me, I pretty much don't listen to the words. You know, I look at him and one of the things that they can't hide is their reactions. You know? So I read body language, I read reactions. You know? So those are the kinds of things that they pretty much taught us. My father, one of the things that generally was expected of a black male at that time was to say yes sir and whatever, and pretty much agree, you know, with anything a white person told you. You know, for an example, if they say it, you know, the sun is shining out there, isn't it? It could be raining, and he would say yes sir, it sure is, you know, just raining. And then he would come back and say, you know, he got to be a fool. He must think that I'm just ignorant, you know. And he told me, you know, that he was only doing that because, you know, that was what was expected. But, you know, he let me know that, you know, that he didn't buy into that system. You would have to, I guess, see my father as he operated around that fraternity house. And when I say that he was a mentor, then that's what he was. My father was a very important cog in that fraternity. Okay. Generally, when a white parent brought their sons to school, and if they were deeps, they turned that son over to my father and say, here he is, you do whatever needs to be done to make him a good deep. Okay. And that's what my father did. He not only made sure that those kids went to school, but he taught them the social graces of fraternity, drinking and carousing and whatever. But always with a focus on going to class and getting an education. When I say that he was a cog, there were many deeps that called him on telephone and talked to him personally and said, Eddie, we have a young man up here in Salisbury that we want you to get into the fraternity. Okay. And he played that role. And he would say, okay. Sometimes the fellas may blackball somebody that the alumni deeps and my father thought ought to be in the house. My father was astute enough, man, that he could keep that tied up and make them change. Let me back up and say that my father was a deep. Okay? He was inducted into the house in 1946, okay, right after the war. Now, growing up in segregation, and my father being a deep, you know, gave me mixed feelings, you know. During that time, they were paddling the pledges. In other words, they had a pal, and when they were bringing them across, man, every deep got to paddle somebody. You know, and here's my father out there, you know, initiating these guys, you know, just like anybody else. He was a deep. And not too many people understood that he was in the fraternity. Okay? So they called upon him, you know, and he played that role. He was still the custodian or janitor or whatever you want to call him. But he did what he, however much that he wanted to do. If you talk to him, he did a whole lot of cleaning up. If you talk to me, I don't think he did too much because he had me going up there every day. I went up to the deep house every day. I was doing the cleaning, you know. On the weekends, man, he didn't even come up there. He bought me a bicycle so I could get up there so he could lay in the bed and I could ride to the deep house. And I cleaned that deck house, okay? My father loved to hunt. Okay, and there were many a mornings that he went somewhere deer hunting, you know, for daybreak. Well, that meant I had to get up and go to the deck house and clean up before I went to school, you know. So the two of us, you know, took care of that deck house. And during the holidays, he'd give me a list of things, man, because all the kids would be gone, things that I need to clean up and make sure that we're right. And my father come back and he would inspect it, you know, floors waxed, windows washed, and whatever. Now, there were also some deeks that lived in Chapel Hill, like Charlie Schaffer, you know, and some others. Well, they'd take a tour and they'd give me a list. So I used to hate to see all these people coming, man, giving me these lists. Because a lot of times they would be different. And everybody inspecting the deck house, you know, to give me these things, man, to do. They, like, worked me to death, you know.
They really put on the spot.
Yeah. Now, on the weekends, after they'd have a party or after the football game, those guys tore the house up. You know, dip cans and whatever. The house was a wreck. Sometimes they pulled the furniture out on the front porch and stuff, man, and... Well, you know, like I was saying, my father didn't go up there. I mean, it was my job to go up there and clean up. And I'd get that house back together, you know, and I would pull furniture in best I knew how. I guess I was 12 or 13 years old, you know. And if some weren't drunk, you know, they would help me get the furniture back in, you know. But that house was spick and span by the time that they would get up. Now, my father would come later, and he'd mix orange juice, and he'd mix tomato juice, and he'd take it around, you know, because all those guys had hangovers, you know. And my father would give him their hangover portions, you know. And if some wanted something to eat or that sort of thing, you know, that's what he did. He treated those kids, man, like royally. And that's why they loved him so. You know. I went to the deck house every day. Okay. Now, I played football and basketball. I could not go to practice until I went up and cleaned up. You know. I had this bicycle, man, and if I was going to go to practice, I guess he had some arrangements with the coaches that they knew that I had to go up and pretty much I didn't do anything but run the vacuum cleaner and straighten up, you know. And then I'd come back and go to practice, okay. If we had travel that get on my bicycle, man, and go up and vacuum and whatever before I could go on the trip. Now, I understand a little bit of what my father was doing. Okay, I was only a child, you know, and my father was determined that I was going to not grow up spoiled. So I think he sort of bent over backwards of making sure that I had chores and that I didn't have no idle time. So I worked pretty hard as a kid. My mother was a school teacher, and she taught school in a rural. So when I got out of school, I got out of school here. Then there was nobody home, so my father made sure that I was going somewhere, and then I was occupied. And I used to cry and say, you know, why can't I play football, basketball with the neighborhood kids? He said, you can after you go to work. So he was pretty hard on me. He was very strict and whatever. Now, my grandmother died when I was, his mother, when I was 10. Okay. My grandma brought a good balance, you know, to talking to him when she thought he was being too hard on me. Okay. And she would say, son, you know, I'll talk to your father. You don't have to do that and whatever. If he was going to whip me or something, man, I'd run through the field. She lived right up do the field there, you know. And I'd go to my grandma's, man. And I didn't get no whipping, you know. I was sort of special to my grandmother. One of the reasons is I carried the name Caldwell, and there were 12 brothers and sisters. None of the brothers had sons that carried the name. That was a big thing for my grandmother, and I carried the name on. So I was very special. She died when I was 10, man. That was a big loss for me, because I handled my run interference. You know, I kind of used my mother, you know, to a certain extent, but, you know, when the mother and father get together, man, they weren't, you know, wasn't but so much that I could, I mean, they were pretty together on raising me. So those were some of the things that I remember. If school, I was expected to do very well in school. I had a cousin, his name was William Hargraves, his mother, Frances Hargraves. Billy was his name. Billy was very bright. You know, and Billy was a year ahead of me, and Billy set the pace, man, and when I come through, the teachers expect me to do, you know, the same, have the same performance as Billy. Well, I wasn't as bright as Billy, you know, so I had, that was difficult. I was fairly smart, but I wasn't like Billy. Billy read all the time, and, you know, he was just very, very bright. So always coming behind him, you know, was difficult. You know, and we grew up like brothers. As I said, we stayed at my grandmother's until I was 5 or 6, and then we built the house over here. And my aunt built the house, you know, so we still, you know, we're like brothers, except we just lived in different houses at that time. So
they lived right across from
you. Yeah. Well, Catacombs, you know, my first house was 2 doors down, you know, and they lived there, so we grew up in and out of each other's houses. What questions can
you have? You had mentioned the legacy of the Caldwell family. Could you describe more about that? What was the legacy of the Caldwell family?
I really didn't find out about the legacy of the Caldwell family until, I guess, I had finished college. There was a lady here by the name of Adelaide Walters. She was on town council. And she was one of the ones that said that I really need to go to the North Carolina room and look up the history of my family. But before that, you know, different people would tell you things about your great-grandfather being the word I want to use, but community leader. I also knew that my name, Edwin Caldwell, came from a great-uncle. He was a doctor. His name was Dr. Edwin Caldwell. He was really a renowned doctor and an expert in the disease called pellagra. Okay. Pellagra is nothing but a deficiency. So, as you can imagine, blacks and whites, man, were eating well during that time, and so they had vitamin deficiencies and so forth. Dr. Caldwell was well respected by everybody, white doctors and so forth. They used to expect him to come to Duke Hospital going around with the other doctors. Now, you know, we're still back in segregation, okay? But they would not start rounds until he got there. And he went around with them all around. Now, he had to walk to Durham, okay? There is a railroad track that runs, I know you pass it on Estes Drive, but that went to Durham, and he used to walk up and down the railroad track. He had a horse and wagon sometimes. You know, the roads weren't very good. A lot of times they got stuck up, but they would wait for him to come. And he later opened up a practice in Durham. But Dr. Caldwell was pretty famous. Both black and white used to come for treatment. White used to come at night, and he used to treat them in the garage. You know, my grandmother told me, you know, they didn't want to come, they didn't want to be seen coming to Dr. Caldwell to get treatment, but they came because they knew that he was the one that could do something for them. And, well, my grandma wouldn't let them in the house, so they had to be treated in the garage.
Why wouldn't she let them in the house?
And, you know.
They were white.
They were white. I mean, if she had to go to their back door, then they weren't coming in her house. Okay? She's just that strong a woman. Okay? I'm told that Dr. Caldwell raised herbs and so forth and went into the woods and got different kinds of herbs that he used in his practice. Okay. Let me back up and say that Dr. Edmund Caldwell was an uncle. His brother, you know, died with 12 children. And he was practicing in Arkansas. So he left Arkansas and came back to North Carolina to help raise these his brother's 12 kids. And he said, well, if I got to support these kids, I may as well marry my brother's widow. That's what he did. And he raised all those kids, man, as if they were his own. And he had one daughter, you know, from that union. I talked with my father, and he really never remembered his father. Okay, to be honest with you, his father was poison. Okay, he worked in the chemical lab down at the university. He had a drinking problem, and one of the professors switched to alcohol. He switched the ethyl alcohol, and it was labeled ethyl, but it was really methyl alcohol. And when he drank it, he knew that he was poisoned. He tried to get home. I think he got as far as the top of the hill on Church Street before he went blind. And the neighbor people called him. You know, I think my father said that he and his brother went up and brought him home. He didn't live too long after that, so he died. The bad thing about it was the professor bragged about killing this nigger, you know. They had a dinner party, you know, and he was bragging, you know, at the dinner party. And the lady that served it, his cook, the surgery party, came back and told my grandmother, you know, but that was the kind of cruelty and so forth that that happened during those days. I was doing research, okay, on family research. And I was doing real well, putting together the history of the black history of Chapel Hill, as well as on my own family research. When I found out about that, you know, I had to put that aside. It's hard when you see your father and your uncles and so forth crying, man, you know, after repeating that story. And I knew that I could find out, searching the records, who he was. And I really didn't want to do that. I did some soul searching, you know, because I think he changed the history of the family. Yeah, my grandma really hit it hard, man, trying to raise these 12 kids. And I was very, very angry, bitter, and whatever. And I said to myself, even if I found out who he was, it would not be right, you know, to confront his children. It had nothing to do with that. That was him, you know. So I put the research away. I never went back. I don't want to know who it is. But I do know that he changed the family.
That's your father's family.
Yes. Okay. That was land that came from my great-great-grandfather. He had amassed some land holdings. How, I don't know. Okay. But all of the land from Church Street and on the other side, you know, was Caldwell land. And he passed it on to his first five sons, and from that we inherited some of the land. I built my house on air land, and pretty much the land has somehow gotten out of the family. My father was an astute business person, and he helped his brothers and sisters, man, build apartment units and so forth on their land, you know, to give them rent. Since that time, that land has gotten out of the family for one reason or another. One of the things I've been talking with him is that I've made sure, man, that we don't get rid of any land. And I said to my children, you know, we will keep the land in the family. There will be nobody selling no land. Okay? I have tried to buy some of the pieces of land and have gotten away from, well, it's generally happened because the person died and therefore their spouse took the land, and they didn't have the same feeling for Chapel Hill or the land, you know, like we had. And even with me trying to buy it, they won't sell to me. Okay? That's another, it's a jealousy, and it's a sort of thing. They'd rather let it go than to let me have it. So.
What you're describing, mind preservation, is a very liberal family. Do you think your family was different from other black families in the area? Do you interacted with whites in any different way? Do you think others did the same?
I think that to a certain extent there were a lot of black families that interacted with white families. Those were mostly middle-class families. Probably not to the extent that my family did. I interacted on both sides. You know, everybody knew who Alice Neal was. And to give you an example of what I'm saying was, I remember getting my first ticket, driving ticket after I got my license. And I was supposed to go to court. Well, my grandmother went out and told the judge as well as the chief of police, my grandson is not coming to court. He will not be in his court. And I didn't go to court. I'm she had that kind of status. I mean, everybody knew Alice Neal. I remember one night I was watering the grass at the Deke House about 1950. I forgot he left the hose on there, and, you know. So my father called and said, "Did you turn the water?" I said, "No, man." He had a truck at the time, and I got in the truck. I was angry. You know, he sent me back up there. I left the tailgate down, and right at Franklin and Columbia, man, I took off, you know, and the drink bottles, man, in the back, rolled out and burst on the on the pavement. I kept going, and I went and turned the water off, and when I came back, the police were waiting on me. And they had a broom, and I mean, here I am sweeping up glass and so forth in the middle of the night, you know. And they say, "You know you were wrong." And I was wrong. And by that time, I don't know, some call came in, and everybody said I can hear them on the radio, they caught this fella, man, that ran off with these bottles. Well, they were going to take me to jail. Okay? In them days, when they take you to jail, man, they beat you. They beat you with rubber hoses. Okay? I mean, it's known. You're black, they take you to jail, you get beat. Okay? And they were getting ready to take me off. Okay? And they had handcuffs on me, man. I'm about ready to be put into this patrol car to go to jail, and somebody said, "Hey, let's take the handcuffs off, cuffs off him. That's Alice Neal's grandson. You don't need to take him to jail. Let him go." And that's just an example of people knowing me. Okay? Deep connection. Okay? There is a deep connection. Okay?
So where did Alice Neal get her power that you
described?
Is it because of
who
she worked for?
My grandmother was just a strong woman anyway. Okay. My grandfather called her a big ball of fire. I mean, she taught herself to read and the whole bit. She was, I don't know, she just was a strong woman. Okay. She interacted with Frank Graham. Okay. In a way that nobody could else react or interact with. Let me give you an example of what I'm saying. That was a unwritten policy at the time that all the white that had domestics working for them got together and made decisions how much they were going to pay them and that sort of thing. Okay. So they kept the prices pretty low. So anybody, there's a professor moving into the community, and then there was a welcome wagon to tell them, "If you hire somebody here, it's the scale." Well, my grandmother said to Miss Mary, "I need a raise, okay? I need a raise." She said, "Alice, I can't afford to pay you because, you know, the others, this is what they pay. And if I did that, then I would break that code." Well, you know, my grandmother looked her in the eye and said, "Miss Marin, I tell you what, you're either going to pay me, I'm going to take it home, because I will feed my family." Okay. So that would be two or three pork chops and so forth that would be going home with me. You know, and I would prefer that you paid me as opposed to me having to steal it. One way or the other, I'm going to feed the family. So she got a raise. And she was just as strong as she got a raise. She's just a strong woman. You know, Dr. Frank asked her one time, "Alice, why is it that when I ask the gardener or somebody a question, he always agrees to me?" And she said, "Dr. Frank, you know, can't you understand that you pay that man? You think that he's going to sit up and disagree with you?" okay? That's why he agreed with you, okay? And as long as you're paying him, he don't care what he's telling you, no. He said, oh, I never thought about that. He used to read speeches to her, you know, when he had a speech to give. He'd go out to the kitchen and say, Alice, I want you to listen to this speech and you tell me what you think, and she would tell him. Okay. Sometimes she would read it while he was putting on his necktie or something. And one thing that she used to say that would be words in there that she couldn't pronounce. And she'd be reading the speech and she'd always skip it. And she'd read some more and I would skip it. And he said, Alice, what is that skip it? She said, I can't pronounce the word, so I just say skip it. And, you know, that was, she had a real good relationship with him. I found, you know, when he left the university and he went to Raleigh, went to Congress, and he lost the election. I won't even talk about what Jesse Hamlin did to him. You know, they called him a nigger lover, and they read pictures and so forth. Black, you know, gonna be in power, and that's the way they beat him. He was a man of integrity, and he would not fight back.